This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, a new effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's been a long time since I've been this excited about a new natural medical innovation. Zona Plus is the real deal. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally. To find out more, go to tryzona.com or call toll-free 1-888-408-6141. That's 1-888-408-6141 or tryzona.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Once again, it's time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. You can send us questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. We'll answer them to the best of our ability. Subject matter, health, nutrition, medical advances, supplements, exercise, all manners of things related to intelligent medicine. How are you doing today, Layla?
All right, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
Very well, thanks. For those of you new to Intelligent Medicine, Layla Mutin is our Hoffman Center nutritionist. We work together on a daily basis. And she is the possessor of a registered dietitian certification as well as a master's degree in the field of nutrition and something else. Something else. You're a CC. What is it?
CDN.
Oh, a CDN. Okay.
That's a New York State certification for certified dietitian, certified nutritionist.
Okay. Because I think New York State was one of those states where if you give dietary advice, you don't have that, they can arrest you and put you in jail. I'll send you to Rikers Island.
No. It's actually, it would, if New York State had licensing for dietitians, we would be not CDN, but LDN.
Oh, okay.
And then those without the LDN, they could crop down on and say, "Hey, you can't give nutrition advice."
It's happened to people. Yeah, I've actually been being a little sarcastic here because, of course, there are many, literally thousands of people in New York with varying qualifications. Yeah. You know, PhDs and MDs and chiropractors, mm-hmm, and naturopaths and health coaches purveying dietary advice without being a registered dietitian. But there were some states where,
right,
the registered dietitians wanted to gain, in effect, a sort of a trade monopoly on the, mm-hmm, dispensing of nutritional advice. And that was pushed back on and opposed by one of the organizations that I belong to. I'm a CNS, Certified Nutrition Specialist. And, mm-hmm, the license or the certification board for them basically said, "Hey, we have a lot of great trained nutritionists. They don't necessarily have to be RDs. And we don't want to tell a brilliant, somebody who is an expert in the biochemistry of nutrition with a PhD and all kinds of,
exactly,
letters after their names, just because they're not an RD, they can't talk to people."
Right. And to give an example, a nutritionist who I almost consider a mentor, Liz Lipsky.
Yeah.
She's a PhD.
Yeah.
And she's not an RD. And I believe North Carolina, when she lived in North Carolina, they came down on her because she would have been, if she'd been, yep, an RD, would have been licensed as an LDN. They said, "You can't do this." She has a PhD, for crying out,
yeah,
loud. Are,
yeah,
you kidding? So I think she had to move across the border to Virginia.
Yeah. Yes, North Carolina was a real battleground, but I think things are better at this point.
Yeah.
So anything hot and heavy in the news this week?
In the news, not so much.
But you,
however,
got a couple of interesting comments in the mail.
I've got some great, amazing comments here. I want to read this to you, Dr. Hoffman. This,
sure,
one email is from Manuel.
Yeah.
Manuel says, "Earlier this year, I suffered what was a potentially fatal asthma attack. I went to a superb Bronx hospital with an, you know, they exclusively do asthma, COPD."
By the way, I happen to know which of a couple of Bronx,
yeah,
hospitals those were, because that's where I trained up in the Bronx. So it's either he's, mm, talking about Jacoby Hospital, or he's talking about,
I did my internship there at Jacoby.
Oh, Jacoby.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I was there. Or Montefiore Hospital.
Uh-huh.
So, and they, because unfortunately, there's a high population of, frankly, minorities who live in maybe not the greatest housing conditions, seem to be particularly susceptible to asthma. And so yes. they developed an expertise in the Bronx, you know, which is a high minority population, in treating asthma. And go ahead.
So Manuel goes on to say, they started to administer several nebulizer treatments, gave me 40 milligrams of prednisone, and we waited to see the effects. I had already told them I was already taking 20 milligrams of prednisone and several puffs of Ventolin. Well, they informed me that I met the maximum dosage and that a doctor from the trauma unit will be with me shortly. Doctor tested me, and I was still wheezing profoundly.
By the way, the trauma unit might be somebody who's ready to put the breathing tube in, you know, to intubate them.
Right.
You know, just to put them on.
But here's what this doctor did. Manuel says he became concerned and ordered the nurse to administer magnesium intravenously. Within the hour, the wheezing was gone, and I haven't suffered any attacks since and haven't had to take any medication since that day. Thank God.
Wow.
Wow.
Impressive story. Very impressive story.
Yeah. Now, Manuel wants to know.
Yep.
Manuel writes, Dr. Hoffman, I want to take magnesium as a daily supplement to try to prevent severe attacks in the future.
Right.
What would the recommended daily dosage be for this supplement?
Okay. I'll give the answer to that, then we'll talk a little bit about asthma and magnesium. The product that I would recommend that he take is Jigsaw Magnesium because it's well-tolerated and very bioavailable. I would have him take two twice daily or even three twice daily. The reason that I like that is it delivers a lot of magnesium without causing diarrhea. That's a limiting factor with some magnesiums. So that would be the one that I would recommend for him. And then we can maybe maintain the very high levels of magnesium that the IV did. So here's a story on magnesium and respiratory problems. One part of asthma is inflammation. Okay, well, they dealt with the inflammation with the steroids, and it didn't really help that much. Another part of asthma is bronchospasm, and we know that magnesium is what's called spasmolytic. It breaks spasms, and so that's apparently what happened when they administered high-dose magnesium. It relaxed the smooth muscle inside the breathing tubes and relaxed them and opened up the breathing. It's also been shown that in people who are labored breathers, you know, somebody who's in respiratory crisis, often that is such a stressful thing to the body that it engenders magnesium loss, like it's a form of shock. Shock causes magnesium loss, as does respiratory failure. And so one of the strategies when people are extubated, in other words, you're on a breathing tube, it's very hard to get people off breathing tubes. It's called weaning, just like weaning a child from the mother's breast. You become so reliant on an outside source of breathing, it's very hard to get you off. It can take days and days, and you have to keep trying and trying, and it's very hard to get the patient to breathe on their own. Often giving magnesium helps that because it helps to strengthen the respiratory muscles, and they tend to weaken in a state of magnesium deficiency, which is common among patients with severe respiratory problems. So, anyway, you got more on that subject?
Well, magnesium is also. First of all, I think there's pretty much an epidemic of magnesium deficiency, at least in our country, if not all over the world, because of stress. Daily stress can wipe out magnesium. Poor diet will also destroy magnesium because that's a physiological stress on the body.
Many medications.
Medications,
acid blockers, diuretics.
Magnesium. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think magnesium is also used to halt or slow down premature labor.
Yes, absolutely, which is another form of spasm, right? I mean, it's those contractions. You reduce the – it actually is helpful in preeclampsia, which is a devastating bodily meltdown. You just turn on the spigot and just run a lot of magnesium sulfate into the woman suffering from preeclampsia. This is something you can die from. As one of the major characters in Downton Abbey met her demise. That was a plot line.
Sybil, oh, the youngest daughter.
You're a Downton Abbey fan as well. Okay. Well, I was saying, give her some magnesium sulfate. But, of course, they didn't know about that then.
Right.
I was shouting at the screen.
Some magnesium.
Save her.
Yeah. Wow. So this is an extraordinary story from Manuel and
Yeah.
So glad that he's feeling better.
So illustrative. And I've seen it happen also in some of our patients who come in tight, you know, with asthma, and we run a magnesium IV, and they just open up.
Yeah. Other things to do, I think it's important to talk about other supplements for magnesium too. We often test for fatty acid deficiencies. Maybe they could be low in omega-3.
In asthma.
Mm-hmm. So administering fish oil can also be beneficial as well. Yeah. Wow. Best of luck to you, Manuel. That's absolutely wonderful. Continued good health to you.
Yeah.
All right. We have another. This is the day of really great stories. How's this? We've got, and I don't actually have a name on this email, but this person says, I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease in 1987.
Mm-hmm.
A number of years ago, I heard you recommend Fisol, and I wasted no time in getting it and taking it, 9 per day.
That's an enteric-coated fish oil.
Right. Now I take a different brand of enteric-coated super omega-3, which is similar, just a difference in cost and dosage. Although I will always have Crohn's disease, my last colonoscopy on November 16 showed no incidence. I believe it's all due to your recommendation of Fisol. So I have you to thank and hope you continue to recommend Fisol or its equivalent, Dr. Hoffman.
Right, yeah. And thank you very much for the feedback. We love to get feedback like those previous stories. I think it really helps listeners, because we can talk a lot about theory and we can talk about these principles, but when it's illustrated in actual personal experience and rooted in reality, I think it really brings the message home about the power of nutrition. In terms of studies on Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis with fish oil, I have to say the results are mixed. And I'm not denying the importance of this person's experience, because one of the reasons that sometimes studies don't show such robust results is that there's a sub-cohort of responders. Say there's maybe 10 or 20% of people who have a fantastic response, but, you know, 80, 90% of people don't have a really good response. So what it might camouflage a benefit in a subset of some people. Who get a very, very dramatic and robust response to fish oil. The other problem with some of the fish oil studies is it's hard to take that much fish oil. You know, to fish oil, it's hard to stick to it, but I guess this person just really had a lot of faith in me and said, okay, I'm going to take it three times three, 9 a day, you know, over a prolonged period
nine
of time.
A day.
It's expensive. It's, you know, time, you know, it's hard to swallow that many capsules, but that's what you need to take, even 12 capsules possibly for ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, because fish oil is anti-inflammatory. And we know that we want to interrupt those inflammatory pathways. So,
right. Well, I could say anecdotally, I know at least two of our patients with Crohn's disease, when they let up on their enteric-coated fish oil, their symptoms kind of start to come back.
Okay.
So they realize the importance. This is anecdotal, but it's at least two of our patients that I'm thinking off the top of my head right now.
Yeah, and I know the problem, by the way, is that when you have diarrhea, which some of these patients have, particularly with ulcerative colitis, it's a little hard to tell patients on day one, oh, you know, they're having diarrhea, bloody stool, to take right away, start taking 9 capsules of fish oil, because fish oil tends to run through you. And so
it's lubricant. So, it can be lubricant in those cases.
It may take a while to attain the desired dosage, but it's worth a try, among other things. And I don't want to go into all the things, because we frequently talk about ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease here. There's a whole series of supplements that deserve attention. I'll be doing a podcast on this subject in a little while. I think probably January, February.
Great. Terrific.
Actually, I'm being interviewed. This is switcheroo. It's like,
That's great.
Yeah.
Terrific.
All right. One of our favorite guests, Dr. Liz Alschuler, has her own radio program. She's invited me to talk about ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. Mm-hmm. So that'll be fun.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Okay. On to the next question. We have an email from Steve. Dear Layla and Dr. Hoffman, I am confused. I understand about both the paleo and Mediterranean diet philosophies, but they both can't be the best way to eat. Paleo is based on the past, while Mediterranean is based on the present. Actually, not really, Steve. That's also based on the past. But Steve goes on to say, it is accepted now that people living in the blue zones live longer, with less disease, eating a Mediterranean-type diet. Are there any current documented blue zones for the paleo people? Well, if I may respond, Dr. Hoffman.
Please.
There's a lot of overlap between Mediterranean and paleo. And the common denominator is you're eating whole, unprocessed food, untainted food, the way it's found in nature. So there is that. There is not, you're not having your Danish, you're not having sweets, you're not having junk food and crackers and chips and all these other things. Both of those concepts, both of those diet concepts. With regard to blue zones, there's a lot more. There's diet, certainly. But there's also fresh air, clean water, there's community, there's
spirituality,
social support,
often these
spirituality,
places.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yes. Optimism,
exercise, of course. There's
work. Exercise,
yep.
Right.
Yeah. So
possibly the other benefits of the herbs and spices that they're using in their cooking that confer a lot of benefits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the nutraceuticals in the kitchen as well.
So I'm going to offer a quote in response to our listener who's confused. This is F. Scott Fitzgerald, who once said, the test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposed ideas in mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. Okay? Isn't that a great quote? And I'm not making fun of our listener, because, look, there are many such paradoxes and controversies in nutrition. And we have to reconcile them in some way.
Sure.
And it may be that different strokes for different folks is the answer.
Right.
But when it comes to paleo diet blue zones, what is a blue zone? Blue zone is actually, it's the title of a book by, I forgot who.
There's
a website.
Well.
Yeah. And basically he's gone around to different parts of the world, and he's looked at places where there's extraordinary longevity and relatively good health. And he's trying to say, to look at, you know, what are the common denominators of these cultures? And many of them are on plant-based diets, but that doesn't mean to the exclusion of animal protein. And they live in a rural environment that's clean, pollution-free. They have great social supports, great family support. The elderly are not put in nursing homes. They're like, you know, part of the community. They don't lose meaning when they, you know, retire. There's a lot going on. So, you know, as you said.
Right.
So is there...
another name off the top of my head is Weston A. Price.
Right.
Who basically studied traditional diets.
Yes.
Diets in tribal culture, traditional diets of earlier civilization. All of that, we're coming back to natural, unprocessed food the way it's found.
That's actually a good point, is that the closest, I think, to a study of a paleo blue zone would be Weston Price. Offhand, I couldn't think of it, but of course he did this work in the 1930s and 1940s, and many of these cultures have actually disappeared. In fact, he was documenting the transition of these cultures to modern diets and modern lifestyles, because the cultures were rapidly transforming. They were in Africa, they were in South America, they were in Asia. And what he found was that from one generation to another, there was a profound deterioration in health. Another observation is that, you know, we now look at the Native Americans in America. There's really a health crisis on reservations and among Native Americans, because a very high percentage of diabetes, very high percentage of addiction, very high percentage of obesity. But if you look at the initial accounts of the European explorers who landed, the European explorers were short. We know that because, you know, you look at the architecture of some of these castles and monasteries from the Dark Ages, and it was rare to find really tall individuals, partly because their diet was really inadequate. They, you know, ate a lot of grains. They suffered from many degenerative diseases. It's believed that Alfred the Great, you know, who was the great founder of England, suffered from ulcerative colitis. historically. He was sick for, you know, his entire life, and the historical accounts describe symptoms that make it sound like he had ulcerative colitis on a grain-based diet. But the Native Americans that they encountered, they have drawings that marvelously tall, robust, strong, you know, performing incredible feats of strength. That is as close as we can come to discovering a blue zone for paleo diet. Now, the problem with these blue zones is that on the one hand, you had maybe pristine diet and you had maybe ideal conditions when it came to lots of exercise and exertion, clean air and water. But you also had a very hostile, challenging environment where animal attacks, warfare between tribes, famine and starvation really took a toll, so that there are very few people who attained the ages that people attain nowadays because they simply couldn't survive, and high infant mortality too. So, you know.
Oh. Yeah. I also want to say to some degree that we have to also, I like to be specific. When somebody says a Mediterranean diet, I almost want to say, whose Mediterranean diet?
What are we talking about
here?
Yeah, right.
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 Because in the U.S., the Mediterranean diet is defined as heavy grain-based,
right,
low in fat, fish, poultry, soy, fruits and vegetables. And to quote a doctor whose name I don't remember off the top of my head, but it's a cardiologist. It was in a recent Medscape article, he said that in America, they've bastardized the Mediterranean diet to suit all of that. Because if you go to Europe, if you go to those Mediterranean regions, if you go to places like Greece, it's like, where's the lamb chop?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's more olive oil than that. And there's more, you know, the Mediterranean diet is not low in fat. It's 40% fat. A low-fat diet is 30% fat. Or less. So there's a reference point. It's not a low-fat diet, and it's been made to be so here.
Right.
Anyway.
Well, the food served in Italian restaurants bears about as much resemblance to Italian food in traditional Italian cooking as does Chinese food in Chinese restaurants. They had to customize it to Americans' portion requirements and Americans' tastes, because, you know, the old joke when I was growing up is, and it's just, it was like a meme. It was like, I just had Chinese food. I'm starving. Right? So they
have that MSG.
And they were very enterprising, the first Chinese who came to set up the restaurants, you know, across the country. You know, long time we've had Chinese restaurants in places like San Francisco and in New York and so on. But there's a Chinese diaspora across the country. And whenever the Chinese restaurants came to town, people would look at it and say, well, you know, I just ate Chinese food. I'm starving. So they had to really hype it up and make it really rich and fried and very, very satisfying to American taste buds. Anyway, same thing's happening in China, though, too. You know, obesity rates going through the roof. So it's nobody's eating traditional diets hardly anywhere in the world anymore.
That's true. More westernized diets have traveled over there.
In fact, they've declared the Mediterranean diet a World Heritage thing. You know, mostly World Heritage things are like, you know, monuments and, you know, ancient cities and things like that. But the Mediterranean diet, it's actually an endangered species of a sort, you know.
Yeah. All right, Steve, don't be confused.
Yeah. Try to hold two ideas in mind at the same time. All right. Thank you very much for your wonderful email. And let's pause now because we divide our podcast into two parts.
Okay.
And Layla, give us a preview as to what we'll tackle in part two.
Okay. I've been trying to get to the bottom of why I suffer from fatigue.
Oh, all right. We'll tackle that when we return. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Hoffman Center Nutritionist Layla Mutin. And this is our weekly Q&A with Layla on Intelligent Medicine Podcast Series.